This is an encore presentation of Faith and Finance.
Tithing is fairly simple in your working years. Your only decision is whether to tithe on your net or gross income. I am Rob West, but tithing becomes a bit more complicated when you retire. Then it's deciding on net or gross income, plus tithing on earnings alone or earnings and principal. See what I mean? So we're bringing in an expert to help you make those decisions. We're off today, so please hold your phone calls. This is Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. Biblical wisdom for your financial decisions. Well, it's my pleasure to have Anthony Saffer with us on the program today. He's a certified financial planner with One Degree Advisors, where they put together a handy resource to help you decide how to tithe in retirement. Anthony, great to have you with us.
Yeah, good to be with you, Rob.
Now, I know you want to lay the biblical foundation for tithing in the first place, because some folks come down on different sides of this issue, whether or not tithing is still appropriate for us now that we're under the law of Christ versus the law of Moses. So give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, tithing, we get to tithe. What a great opportunity to demonstrate worship, trust, and obedience to God. And as our friend Ron Blue likes to say, if you're not tithing, you're not experiencing financial freedom. The thing is that tithing was actually introduced in Genesis 14 before God gave the law to Moses. And so you see Abraham tithing to the king priest Melchizedek. And it's actually a great study in Hebrews 7. They talk about this specific incident in the New Testament. And I think it's just a great, you know, backing to show why tithing applies today. And even from Jesus's mouth in Luke 11:42, the way I read it is that he's telling the religious leaders, make sure you're tithing, but you're not neglecting love and justice.
Yeah. Well, I think you make a good point, though. It's what we get to do, not what we have to do. And I love what my friend Randy Alcorn says, that tithing is the training wheels of giving, because Jesus raises the bar in every area, and that includes our giving. But what a great starting point to give systematically and proportionately as an act of worship on God's provision. Well, I mentioned that tithing is easier during our working years than it is perhaps during those retirement years. So explain why that is.
Yeah, so tithing literally means a tenth, and so it's often simple to calculate from our working income. If I earn $10,000, a tenth is $1,000. The math's pretty simple there.
Right.
And so some people do question, well, should I tithe from gross before tax or net after tax income? And that's a personal decision that you'll need to make. I think that the first fruits principle would seem to apply to tithing prior to paying the government. Yeah. But in either case, it's an easy calculation by applying that 10% to an income amount. So many retirees choose to tithe similarly to how they do in their working years. They simply tithe on whatever income they do receive.
Right.
But we started getting the question from some of our retired clients, well, how do I tithe in retirement just because my income sources vary in timing and composition and feature really some form of a return of principal? And that really led to many meaningful conversations.
Oh, I can imagine it did. And these are good-hearted people who just want to honor the Lord appropriately in this season of life. And it can get complicated. I mean, there's multiple sources of income that each include a return of principal in this season, right?
That's right. And so that's why in the guide, we really highlighted five common income sources: Social Security, pensions, retirement accounts, brokerage investment accounts, and rental property income, just to name a few. So as you imagine, it can get confusing. The guide's really not to try and tell people what to do, but really to provide a context so that they can apply it to their individual situation. Hopefully you can prayerfully apply a plan that's best and that you can have confidence in that. So one of the income sources, Social Security, let's just kind of go through those quickly. Social Security, you're paying in through your payroll taxes, right? And if you get a benefit statement from the Social Security website, you can actually see how much you've paid into that. A pension can be similar in the sense that you may be paying into that pension, maybe your employer is paying in as well. It can be unique in each situation. A retirement account, such as an IRA, is generally made up of contributions plus some earnings or growth. And similarly, a brokerage account can be just like that. The main difference there is that you're paying taxes, you know, as you go and through as you're earning that.
Yeah, so then you have to decide if you want to tithe on earnings not yet distributed and possibly even tax-free income that doesn't show up on your tax return. Well, how do you handle all of this? Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Anthony Saffer will help us think through how you approach tithing in retirement. Much more to come just around the corner. Stick around.
This is an encore presentation of Faith and Finance.
Great to have you with us today on Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. We're talking today with Anthony Saffer. He's a certified financial planner with One Degree Advisors, and we're talking about tithing in retirement. It's simple. During your working years, and you simply give a tenth on your increase. But what about in your working years where you have different kinds of income, and many of those income sources represent money you've already paid in and therefore tithed on, but also earnings and other forms of income coming back your way? It gets a bit more complicated. And Anthony, when we're transitioning into this season of life, it can be complicated, including the financial piece, right?
That's right. I mean, income sources are changing. You know, somebody's retired, they're figuring out how to live with their time, and then their money aspects are changing. And so when it comes to tithing, that question of, well, how do I tithe in retirement? There really are two options, at least as we see it. So one is pretty simple. The other is a tad bit more complicated. But before personally deciding how to tithe in retirement, it can really be helpful to note your priorities. Are you aiming to keep things simple? Are you willing to apply a little bit more detailed calculation to it? And perhaps you need to minimize tithing just to help make ends meet. In the case for more simple, you're really just tithing off what's deposited into your bank account, plus adding any other money that's withheld, perhaps for taxes. So let me give you a quick example. Let's say our friend Mary, she's retired. She wants to continue tithing to her local church. So every month she receives Social Security and then a distribution from her IRA. Okay. She simply adds up that income that comes into her bank account, adds back in any money that was withheld for taxes, and applies that 10%. And there she has her tithe. It's simple and it's impactful.
Yeah. Well, what about some other examples, Anthony, like a pension?
That's right. So with a pension, it would be really the same thing in terms of what may hit a bank account. A lot of times if someone receives, let's just say $3,000 as their pension payment, they're just going to simply apply that $300 pension. If someone wanted to apply perhaps a detailed calculation that said, hey, I paid in this much as principal and I've already tithed on that money, then they can break it down to say, well, how much have I contributed versus how much is actually growth or earnings that I'm now applying the tithe to. And we created a free resource that helps people basically sit down with each income source and really just apply a plan that's unique and personal to them.
Yeah, very good. So would you recommend then a percentage if somebody wanted to recognize the portion that's being returned to them and then just apply that percentage, whether that's from the Social Security statement or from the total contributions into your retirement plan to every check coming out?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just take an example and let's use an IRA account. So okay. Because this is common to a lot of people. So we'll go back to our hypothetical friend, Mary. She has $1 million in her IRA account. She's done a good job of savings. And because she's done it over many years, let's just say her principal is $250,000. Those are her contributions. Yeah. And then $750,000 is growth over the long term. So of that 75%, that's growth. If you apply that to the principal, let's say she has a $4,500 IRA distribution, you apply 75% to that $4,500, which comes out to $3,375. That's the earnings that she's actually getting from that. And then you can just apply your tithe to that. Same thing with something like Social Security or a pension.
Yeah. Is that where most of your clients come down, or are most of them just taking the simple approach to say everything I get is a gracious gift from the Lord, whether or not a portion of it is a return of capital, and therefore I'm just going to tithe on everything coming in?
I'd say more people take the simple approach, and they really want to create that impact. Sometimes it's harder for certain people that are trying to make ends meet. In either case, we need to be trusting the Lord through that. But I will say that it's never going to be exact. And you don't want to fall into that trap of feeling guilty over this. prayerfully go through it, talk with your spouse about it. And that's why having just a plan where you can have confidence, apply those calculations, and then feel good about it. And if it's something where you are applying a percentage to it, often people will run with that percentage for quite a while or for their lifetime, and they're confident in that. And then they can really just spend their time serving the Lord with not only their finances, but with their time and their heart.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Let's take one other example. What about an income property, like a rental property? How would you help folks think about their tithing on that?
Yeah, good question. And a lot of times people will have rental properties when they are working, and then that carries into retirement. So often they'll keep the same method that they have into retirement. But a lot of times, like if you're getting a gross income, let's just call it $2,000 a month in rental income, but you're putting in $500 of expenses, you treat it like a business. And so the $1,500 is really the income that's coming to you. And then people will often apply that percentage to the net income. Now, that can be changing on a year-by-year basis. So we do have a lot of clients that just simply say, hey, let's just apply the tithe to the gross income and let's make it simple.
Yeah, very good. I know you help folks with tax-efficient ways to do their giving in retirement. What would be some of the most effective that you've seen?
A lot's changed with tax reform. It seems like there's a new tax law every year, and especially in 2018 through the major tax reform, what we noticed was that obviously a lot fewer people were itemizing their deductions because the standard deduction had gotten so much higher.
Sure.
And in talking with people, they didn't realize that they were not getting the tax benefit that they once were from their charitable giving. So we talk to people often about stacking your tithe, which basically just means supersizing it essentially in 1 year, and then the other year taking a standard deduction. And one way to help facilitate this is using appreciated stock to tithe in retirement. Even a donor-advised fund, such as with our friends with National Christian Foundation, can be a great strategy. And then the third thing I would add, Rob, is qualified charitable distributions from IRAs. These are can help fulfill those required minimum distributions. But honestly, it's just a really tax-efficient way to give directly from your IRA.
Yeah, that's helpful. Now, you mentioned a donor-advised fund. We talk about them often. I refer to them often as a charitable checking account. Will you give just a quick thumbnail sketch for somebody who's not familiar with that term?
Yeah, it's a giving fund. And so essentially you can set that up with the community foundation. They act as the intermediary for that. And when we give over to a community foundation, it's essentially a completed gift at that point in time. And so it goes to the community foundation, which is a charity. And that's really what determines the tax break. So I can supersize my giving in one particular year from a tax standpoint, but then I can further distribute that money later on, even though the money's with the foundation. As it says in the name, it's a donor-advised fund. And so the community foundation basically takes your recommendations to give to the final charity, whether it be a church or another ministry.
Yeah, that's helpful. We've got about just 30 seconds left, Anthony. So tie a bow on the tithing for us. This is really about a conversation between you and the Lord, not trying to check a box and making this legalistic, right?
Absolutely. And that transition into retirement can be a big step for people. And so having a plan can help give you that confidence, not only with tithing, but with those different retirement income sources, your time. You want to be able to go in there and have that financial freedom, as Ron Blue often talks about, so that you can serve the Lord faithfully.
Wow, that's really helpful. Well, Anthony, so appreciate your time today. Thanks for stopping by, my friend.
Thanks, Rob.
All right. Folks, you can get access to this free tool in our show notes today. You can also learn more at OneDegreeAdvisors.com. That's OneDegreeAdvisors.com. Our guest has been Anthony Saffer with One Degree Advisors. What a great discussion. I know it's been helpful to you. Much more to come just around the corner, including your questions. Stay with us.
This is Faith and Finance with Rob West, and today's broadcast was one of our most popular in 2023. Our phone lines will not be open today, but as always, you can email your question to askrob@faithfi.com.
Thanks for joining us on Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. Let's head to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Corey, you're next on the program. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering. I have a house that I had for, actually what happened is I got married, okay? We moved into a house that we bought from her dad, and we still had that primary home of hers. We didn't rent it or anything. It needed work. So we fixed it up over the last 6 years. You know, new roof, new heating and air unit. And we finally got it done this past year when the market was so high. Thank the Lord, because it went up really high. And we made a lot of money, more than what we could think we could make on it. But so, you know, we cleared around $130,000. And I'm wanting to know how to go about this. What's the tax laws as far as, is that a straight up capital gains that I'm going to have to pay on this? Or, and can I write off my $58,000 that we put into it, mm-hmm. all those type of things?
Yeah, very good. So the first question is, did you live in the house 2 out of the last 5 years as your primary residence?
Well, my kids did, but I can't say I did.
Okay. All right. If you could say that, and I understand you can't, that would allow you to have up to $500,000 as a married couple in gains without paying any capital gains tax. But since you did not live there, as your primary residence 2 out of the last 5 years, then it would be considered an investment property. And then as long as you held it more than a year, it would be a long-term capital gain, which, you know, for most folks, that's going to be 15%. If you're married filing jointly and you have income between $89,000 and $550,000, you'll pay 15% capital gain. If you have less than $89,000, you would pay nothing in terms of capital gains. Now, in terms of establishing the gain, you would take the selling price minus that original purchase price, your cost basis, and then you could also further reduce it by certain improvements. And you'd probably want to check with a tax preparer just to determine exactly what could be considered an improvement that would reduce that cost basis versus what would be just general wear and tear. But generally speaking, if it's something that stays with the property, not maintenance, and you know, you've got wood that rotted around a window and you replaced it, not that kind of thing, but if you did something to improve the value of the property, then that would be, you know, able to be reducing the cost basis.
Okay. Yes, the best thing to do is find a CPA really quick this week and see what they can do for us, I'm sure.
I think that's right, just to make sure you get that right. And if you were ever questioned, that you've got a good rationale for how you establish that cost basis.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, mm-hmm. as far as writing it off, it's not necessarily going to mean I can write the whole $57,000 off just because of certain things. You know, even the heating and air unit may not be that situation because it was an improvement from the old unit, you know, that was really inefficient. But
yeah, that's a good question. And that I would rely on your CPA's counsel to determine whether or not you could add something like that. So I wouldn't want to weigh in on that specifically, but I think this is the year for you to get some wise counsel as you establish that. Good news is, like I say, for most folks, it's either 0 or 15% net capital gains, unless you're making over $553,000 if you're married filing jointly. So it's pretty reasonable, I guess I would say. I think capital gains rates, unfortunately, are headed higher in the days ahead. So you at least can enjoy that for the time being. Hey, Corey, thanks for calling today. We appreciate it. To Covington, Indiana. Hi, Greg. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I got a question. You're talking about getting scammed on credit cards, too many credit cards, too much information out there. Do I need something like LifeLock on my accounts? Would that be the wise thing to do? Would you have an opinion on that?
You know, I do, and I'm not a big fan of it. I mean, if one of your financial institutions gets hacked and they are going to pay for some sort of monitoring service for you, which often they will for a period of time, you know, I would take full advantage of it. If it's something you're coming out of pocket from, it could be anywhere from, you know, $12 to $35 a month. I mean, it's fairly expensive, and it goes up after the first year. And there's lower tier plans, but they're generally not comprehensive and no family coverage. You know, I think, you know, for the most part, it's not going to prevent you from identity theft. It's essentially going to monitor threats to your identity, alert you when threats are detected, which a lot of your credit card companies in particular and your bank will do that anyway. And then they'll help you recover from identity theft. But all the steps are out there at FTC.gov and other places where you can get a lot of helpful free information about if you do find out that your identity's been compromised in some way, kind of what are the steps you take, everything from reporting it, getting a police report, letting the FTC know, changing passwords, closing, changing account numbers on financial accounts. I mean, all of those steps are pretty clearly outlined. So from my standpoint, although it may give you some added peace of mind, and if you got some extra margin in your budget and that would give you that peace of mind, then I'd say go for it. Apart from that, I would say it's an unnecessary expense.
I appreciate that. And thinking along that line, would you have any, say, ABC suggestions, 1, 2, 3 musts to prevent identity theft? Say some common causes of identity theft that we could, as public, be on guard for. Maybe some things that we aren't doing that we should be doing, or keeping an eye on things better. I'd appreciate your comment on that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So a couple of just general ideas. One would be freeze your credit. That's a pretty simple process. It's free. You'd have to do it with each of the three bureaus, Experian, TransUnion, or Credit Experian, TransUnion, and Equifax is the third one. That essentially involves you putting a PIN number on your credit file so nobody can access that to open an account in your name without the PIN number to thaw it out. Well, if somebody's trying to fraudulently open an account in your name, they won't be able to provide the PIN number, and now the account doesn't get opened. I would never respond to any inquiries by phone or by email that are asking you to click a link or give out information over the phone. That's a phishing scam, and they're very good at impersonating reputable financial institutions. So just don't do it. Don't click links and emails. Don't give information over the phone, no matter who they say they're with. Use strong passwords, change them often, and don't ever use public Wi-Fi for your transacting business. Hopefully that helps you, Greg. Thanks for calling today. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
You're listening to a best of broadcast of Faith and Finance with Rob West. This program is pre-recorded and one of our most popular broadcasts that aired this past year. We're not available to take your calls today, but you can email us at askrob@faithfi.com.
Thanks for joining us on Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. Let's head back to the phones to the Pacific Northwest. Hi, Rachel. Go right ahead.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So if we can just put this in a small area here. We are considering changing our traditional IRA in a managed account, a traditional managed account, which we've had for a long time, to precious metals, a self-managed precious metals account. Yeah. And so I have a few questions about that. Is this wise or overreactive? And the other thing is that it would be all from the traditional managed account going into the precious metals account, mm-hmm. where the precious metals are stored somewhere else, not in hand, and there would be a custodian responsible for transactions. So that's the main question.
Yeah.
What
does this IRA represent as a part of your total investable assets? What percentage?
A lot.
Okay. Like more than 50%?
Probably right at that.
Okay. Yeah.
Well,
so
actually, because it would be at least 50%.
Okay. So that would be my concern. I mean, do I have a problem with the precious metals? No, I think that can be a great investment. And I think this is the time to be at the upper end of your range. But we typically say that range is 5 to 10% of your investable assets, not 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 or more, just because it doesn't produce any income. It doesn't historically perform as well as a stock and bond portfolio. It has more volatility. And I realize that in times of uncertainty, we see a lot more people buying it. And I understand why. It's a store of value. It's a hedge against that uncertainty and fear that can exist in times like we have going on right now, just given what we've come through and the inflation we're dealing with, the prospect of a recession, some of the decisions we see happening around us with the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government and just, you know, the debt levels in this country. I mean, I get it. But I think any potential major problem here in this country, economically speaking, is pretty far down the road. I think in the near term, like in the next several decades, we'll be able to weather these storms. I think, in fact, the market will recover quickly once we see the Fed is done raising interest rates and once we know we're through that recession. Now, I don't think we've seen the bottom on this market. We talked to Bob Dahl, Chief Investment Officer at Crossmark Global. He joins us each Monday with his market analysis, and he reminded us that every time we have a recession, we make a new bear market low from the previous cycle. So that would say that, given that whether or not we've been in a recession, we are technically not in one right now. We expect to be in one later this year. That means if history holds true, we will go below those October 2022 lows before we go higher, but I think we will. So I think a better strategy is to say, yeah, I want some exposure to gold, but I'm not going to get overweighted there and highly concentrated, because the compounding effect of me having my investable assets working for me in a stock and bond portfolio, despite the fact that the next year might be a little challenging, we're looking over decades. And we're saying, even once we get to retirement, we still have, if the Lord tarries and we're in good health, 20, 30 years for that money to grow, and you're going to do better in a properly diversified stock and bond portfolio, just at least historically speaking. Now, let's talk about the self-directed IRA specifically. I don't have any problem with that either. There are higher fees associated with these self-directed IRAs. They have to, as you said, the gold has to be stored in an IRS-approved depository, and you have still the usual RMD requirements, although those are getting older. So it's going to be up to 75 years old soon, so it sounds like you guys have quite a bit of time there. But it's just a lot of expense and trouble, you need to make sure that you really believe it's worth it. Another approach would be to own a gold tracking stock, like an ETF that tracks the price of gold, not a mining company where they have their own sales and earnings and potential problems, but a tracking ETF that literally mirrors the price of gold. That would be another way to do it. And then you don't have to take any possession. You could hold it in your traditional IRA. So those are just some thoughts. Again, you're the steward. You need to make this call. But I guess my questions would be, is it worth the cost and complexity of the self-directed IRA to own the gold physically? And then secondly, it sounds like you're pretty highly concentrated, and I think that violates the diversification rules I would encourage you to consider for your overall investment strategy.
Yeah, I felt like that kind of went against that whole "don't put all your eggs in one basket" thing. And
a little bit, yeah.
they're really all in one basket there. We were considering it more for the fact of safety or preserving what we already have, as sure. Like everyone else seeing it just nosedive. And then, we are at that age where we are definitely soon to retire. And, we'll have a retirement fund, but also, all that we've been saving for so long. As much to protect it, like that, well, if you are invested in that, then it's there, it's at least worth what it's worth, and it doesn't make any more money. So, well, hopefully it is making some money because it's hopefully increasing in value, but
right. Doesn't generate an income and it's hard to what do you do if you want if everything does really go south, what do you do with it? Do you try to get it back and take possession of it and chip away a piece, to barter with? So it does become problematic from that standpoint if we're playing out these kind of worst case scenarios.
Yes. And, I it wouldn't be stored at, that amount. It'd be in a vault somewhere, I guess.
Sure.
Managed
yeah.
by the whoever, wherever that is.
The custodian,
is. And
sure.
So, just to get through, just to get us through the unknown time, which we don't know really how long that time is going to
And I guess that's the problem. And unfortunately, I'm going to have to take a break here in just a second. But that's the challenge here, Rachel, is when we look at the performance of the stock and bond portfolio going back to the 1920s, we see how well the market has done despite the ups and downs. But we can't, as soon as we try to time the market and pick our entry and exit point, so we quote unquote miss the turbulence with this idea that we're going to get back in at some point, that missing that recovery, which is invariably what happens, just completely skews the results, because you could sit on the sideline in gold feeling very good about it. And then when the market recovers and the economy's back up and running again, inflation's back down and we're through the recession and the job market's strong again, all of a sudden the market has recovered and gone to a new high. And now you're thinking about buying back in. So I guess that's, from my standpoint, I'd rather take a diversified approach, have 10% in gold, but the rest in stocks and bonds, and just stay the course and really see this as a long-term play, what the Bible calls steady plotting. That's just my perspective. At the end of the day, you guys need to pray about it and make that decision, and we'll just trust the Lord will give you some wisdom on that. Rachel, thanks for being on the program today. God bless you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Faith and Finance with Rob West. Please remember that our program today is pre-recorded, so our phone lines are not open. We're going to pause now for a brief break, and then we'll be back with more Faith and Finance. This is an encore presentation of Faith and Finance.
Thanks for joining us on Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. Let's move through these final questions here in our last segment today, starting in Indianapolis. Angie, how can I help you?
Hey there. My husband and I are selling our house, and our goal is to downsize. We've got enough equity in the house that we can pay off what we owe on the current house, and then really what our goal is to pay cash for the next house. Yeah. And then also out of that, we'd like to take what's left over, which is we're estimating to be about $50,000. And we're either going to pay off, well, my husband wants to pay off our external debt. So the challenge with this is I'm a business owner. I have a commercial mortgage. I'm about 4.5 years in. It is it's an SBA loan held by a bank, and it's at prime, so it's at 10% right now interest. And my home is currently collateral for that.
Yeah.
So my choice here is to the mortgage company has said that they will take the first position or take the lien off or the collateral off for us to do what we need to do. They want to take that equity and put it towards my commercial mortgage instead of letting us have it to pay off external debt. So my other option here is to refinance, and I've talked with a bank. They're willing to do like a 40-60 split of 40% of a 501 SBA loan, and they handle 60%. And they're saying that right now the average of that would be, combining the two, it's going to be about 7.5% to 8%. And then in 2 years, we can rework the loan for the percentages. And I'm just trying to figure out what's really going to be the best route to go here, because with my current loan, I currently owe like $645,000. When we went to the other bank for the refinance, they're wanting to refinance, about $760,000, so more than that is what they're saying. And I'm really just trying to see what is going to cost me less as a business owner, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I think you have to determine how high a priority is releasing that personal residence. You know, what a lot of folks don't realize is that they can negotiate when it comes to these loans and try to negotiate out their personal residence from the bank's collateral at the time of the loan. Once you do it, they're not going to allow that to happen, but they're going to take, you know, every piece of collateral they can get, starting with your primary residence. And so, you know, I would say, you know, we want to try to negotiate out of that if at all possible. And I think you've got to decide how important that is to you as a part of the equation, in addition just to the overall expense of the loan itself. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm actually not opposed to, you know, to working in that way, because it takes a big chunk out of the current mortgage that I have. I mean, even though the interest rate is at 10%, and I've been paying the principal just to try to get it down. But I think the challenge is, you know, my husband, he's really determined to pay off that external debt. And,
sure.
You know, it's credit card debt that he's accumulated. He wants to get that. He wants us to be completely debt free, and I understand that. And it would be nice to be free, you know, to have the business finally separated from the personal. I think that's, I mean, it is important, because we may want to do other things, but I just don't want it to cost me a ton of money to refinance, you know, all for the sake of just getting our house off of the loan.
Yeah. So I think that's really the issue at the core of this. I mean, I agree. I don't want you to pay a fortune either. At the same time, we've got to determine, you know, at what point are we unwilling to allow the business to be mixed with your personal finances, which is it is now. If something were to happen to the business, you could be putting your home, or you are putting your home, at risk. One other option to consider, Angie, is a credit union. A lot of times a credit union will make a business loan and they'll offer a more suitable solution than a bank, because they're member owned. They're much more likely to exclude a personal residence from their collateral requirements, because they just often feel like it's unreasonable to ask for a personal residence as collateral. So that would be one option you could look at. But I think at the end of the day, you're just going to have to decide, yes, there's an added cost to do this. We've got the refinance itself, plus this new interest rate, especially for an uncollateralized loan, or at least one that doesn't include your personal residence. If you had a rental property or raw land or a vacation home, you know, that could be another option. If you had other, you know, assets that you could use from the business itself, that would be ideal. But I would agree, I'd like to get to you out of that collateralizing your personal residence as quickly as you can, even if there's a bit more expense. But if it creates a hardship for you as a small business owner, you are your business, and your business is you. And so your ability to continue to operate is critical. So I think, you know, you and your husband just have to balance that. Look, count the cost, explore every option, including the credit unions. And at the end of the day, you're going to have to put these two options side by side and determine what impact it's going to have on the business. And that's going to quickly tell you how important it is for you to release the home, which I would put in a decision-making matrix at a pretty high priority, but it's not everything. And obviously, if it hinders your ability to operate and creates a strain on the business, then that's not, you know, good either.
Well, it's not going to put us under by any means, but it's definitely going to hurt.
Sure. Yep. So. I get it. Well, we'll ask the Lord to give you some wisdom on that. I think you and your husband get all the facts, get all the numbers, explore your options. I would definitely look at the credit union, and then you all put those side by side. Ask the Lord to give you guys unity in that decision. And I would say, don't make any borrowing decisions unless you guys are on the same page. But once you are, then I would go for it and don't look back. So I appreciate you being on the program today, Angie. All the best to you. I know this is a tough one. Quickly to Miami. Hi, Bob. How can I help you?
Yes, Rob. I have about $330,000 in an IRA, and I'm 72, and with required minimum distribution, it's only about $13,000 a year. And to raise that, my income, I was considering an immediate annuity for like $100,000 would 9% instead of about 4% I'm doing now.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think if you're solving for an income gap on your monthly income that would give you peace of mind to know that I've guaranteed and kind of shored up my budget by now having this guaranteed amount, I don't have to think about the market, especially if you've got a couple hundred thousand in addition to that. That's certainly an option if you get a really attractive fixed annuity rate on that. I can't argue with that. I would just look at the potential that you could have by keeping full access to your capital, not tying it up in an annuity and investing it, with the goal of being able to maintain maybe a withdrawal rate of around 4%, which, at $330,000 is, $13,000 a year, somewhere around $1,000 a month, a little bit more than that. Then you still have access to your capital. But if you want to take a third of it and kind of lock it in and you get a really good rate and that gives you some peace of mind, I'd say go for it. That can be a great option. And it's one of the only cases where I would say an annuity may make sense, even though they're certainly not my first choice because of the loss of capital, the complexity, and the cost. It's a good question, though, Bob. We appreciate your call today. Here at FaithFi, as we near the end of 2023, we need your help to continue to equip God's people to be good and faithful stewards of God's resources, equipping them to integrate faith and financial decisions for the glory of God, so that all Christians ultimately, and this is our vision, would see God as their ultimate treasure, which puts money in its proper place as a tool to accomplish God's purposes. And we do that through educating, equipping, and connecting God's people to be those wise and faithful stewards. And here's what makes us so excited about that is the fruit that comes from it, the life change that occurs by those listening to this broadcast and those in our app and on our website. In fact, let's listen to one of those stories right now.
I just wanted to say, other than Mr. Burkett, you are the only one that I've ever listened to on the radio that told the truth about giving.
Oh, wow.
Especially dealing with tithes. We try to teach people you don't pay your tithes. You pay a power bill, you pay a water bill, a house payment, and you don't like doing that. But when you do like y'all say and learn what the true meaning of giving is all about, it changes your life. And I listen to you religiously daily because I know I'm going to get the truth and I'm going to get the true meaning. And I just want you to know, I really appreciate you being the man of God you are and teaching people the true meaning of giving. And I would challenge anybody out there, take 3 months and learn what the meaning of giving is and see if it don't change your life. Instead of paying your tithes at church, start giving. Just give it.
Yeah.
And learn what the true meaning of giving is that y'all teach.
Wow. That's powerful. That's the power of the Lord at work as you apply His wisdom, not mine, not anyone else's, the Lord's wisdom to your financial life. And here's my experience, folks. When you do that, it's one of the key ways God shapes your spiritual journey in your financial journey. If you'd like to support this work, you can do that online at faithfi.com. Just click give. That's faithfi.com. Just click give. Folks, thanks for being along with us today. I'm Rob West, and on behalf of my team today, producer Devin Patrick, call screener Robert Youngblood, and researcher Jim Henry, I'm Rob West. This has been Faith and Finance here on American Family Radio. We're so grateful for our partnership with AFR, bringing you biblical wisdom as it relates to financial decision-making. Have a great day, and if you want to check out our website, go to faithfi.com. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.